presenting the distinguished international news commentator and foreign correspondent, Raymond Graham Swing. This is another of his programs known as World Events, on which Mr. Swing gives his interpretation of international affairs. Raymond Graham Swing.
Good evening. This has been an extraordinary week in world affairs. It has given us two trials, the Niemöller trial in Berlin and the trial of the old Bolsheviks in Russia. And the two of them together really sum up the spiritual half of the anguish and strife of this unfolding century. I suppose every century has to answer the same questions. What shall become of man's freedom, and what shall become of man's material life? But the questions seem harder to answer today than in the past. And these trials are really epic dramatizations of the problem of freedom as it stands in part of Europe today. They are dramas of tragedy. They don't give the answer. They don't tell what ought to be done. They tell us what forces are at work and that what is being done is tragic. Pastor Niemöller this week received a 7-month sentence for defying the Nazi state. And as he has been in prison since August, he is entitled to his liberty. After the sentence of the court, he was, however, taken back to prison, I suppose to put off the day of celebrations over his release. The whole struggle between the church and the state in Germany comes to a focus in the person of this man, Niemöller. To begin with, it isn't simply a struggle of the state to get the church, Protestant and Catholic, out of politics. If it had been, I think there would have been much sympathy for the state. That would have been a conflict like the one over the separation of church and state in France a generation ago. And people in this country, I think, would have felt that the church had better confine itself to spiritual life and leave politics alone. But that wasn't the issue. A church out of politics can be just as free as one in politics, perhaps even more so. But the Nazis didn't want a free church. They wanted to uproot Christianity in Germany. They disliked its Hebraic origins. They disliked its humanitarianism. They thought it made men soft. But most of all, they wanted the state to have the supreme authority to tell men what to do. They came close to following the old Roman custom of promoting their emperor to a deity, making Hitler the voice of God. So the defiance put up by this courageous pastor was defiance on behalf of conscience and the right of man to obey God in questions of conscience and not the head of the state. Or to put it in another way, it was a brave German's assertion of his individualism as against the claim of the state to control the individual's thinking. And what made the trial highly dramatic is that Martin Niemöller was not a man out of the cloisters. He wasn't unmodern, without sympathy for the Hitler Revolution. He wasn't a pale ascetic. He was a fighter. During the World War, he was commander of a submarine and for distinguished bravery won the highest German decoration, the Pour le Mérite. He loved the daring and the excitement of war, and he was fervently patriotic. And when peace came, rather than sink his submarine at Scapa Flow at the behest of the British, he resigned and became a farm worker, hoping to save up money enough to own his own land. Then German inflation wiped out his savings, and he entered the church, working his way through theological seminary as a day laborer. He disliked the Weimar Republic. He was a super patriot. And so he was among the staunch supporters of the Nazis and Hitler when they came into power. It took just that kind of man to have within himself the qualities to defy the Nazi drift toward paganism and, in defying it, to rally opinion behind him. He was a symbol for the chaplains in the German army, for the sturdy Prussian fighting Protestants, and finally for all those in Germany who feel the need to be individuals with the liberty of their own consciences. That is the kind of a man the Nazis have condemned, the man who fought gloriously for his fatherland, the man whose personal life was manly and fearless, and who, along with these traits, refused to surrender to paganism and the curtailment of conscience. Now, what will be the outcome of this trial? Pastor Niemöller, in effect, has been vindicated. So, in effect, the German High Court has reproved those who prosecuted him. The future would seem to depend on what men and women in Germany feel about the issue the pastor has raised. And if not enough of them are stirred to stand at his side, the neo-paganism of Alfred Rosenberg, the philosopher of the Hitler regime, will march on. And if it does, as German political power grows, it will reach all corners of the earth. And now to look at the Moscow trial. That is quite different, but in one respect it isn't. That, too, is a trial of the opposition and a demonstration of what happens or can happen in the one-party state, the state which rules the mind of the individual. To us, the Russian trial is so utterly foreign to our own procedure and to anything that can happen in our national life as to be weird and fantastic. Here are the great names of Russia, a former premier, a former assistant secretary of state, a former ace ambassador, the once great editor and theoretician of Bolshevism, and so on, charged with crimes of such a low and crude kind as to be beyond the thought of any sane man. I recognize that any comment of mine on this trial, that is, on the issues at stake, is necessarily superficial, but one can legitimately make some observations about it. To begin with, this is not a trial as we understand the word. It has nothing to do with determining the guilt or innocence of the accused men. The evidence is not being weighed by judges who presume, as we do in Anglo-Saxon countries, or we theoretically presume to do, that a person is innocent until he is proved guilty. The Soviet forms of criminal procedure differ from ours. These men have all been found guilty before this trial started. Their guilt was fixed on them by the investigations made in secret. And the aim of the trial is to determine the sentences to be imposed on them. I mean, that is the theory of such a trial. The purpose of it, of course, is to convince the Russian public that the men are guilty and that the punishment they are to get is coming to them. In a sense, the trial is just a stupendous piece of juridical propaganda. It is held to whip up public opinion against the accused. When they are done away with, the Russian people are not to begin questioning, how can it be that these men, whom they trusted so long, and who surely were loyal servants of the revolution, have had to be condemned? Another observation, then, is that this is a trial for home consumption, and the Russian government doesn't care what you or I think, and what is more serious in American opinion, what Europeans think about all, above all, what France thinks. I don't suppose one could have contrived anything so injurious politically as this national advertisement by the Soviet government of a great conspiracy within Russia. Here it is, staged the month after Hitler's victory in Austria, and when Britain is beginning to think in terms of a four-power pact. A four-power pact is the worst thing diplomatically that can happen to Russia, for it weakens the French-Soviet pact of mutual assistance, and so exposes Russia to the full force of German intrigue and perhaps German attack. Now, the men in the Kremlin are not idiots. They know what the effect of the trial will be in Europe, but they hold it all the same, hold it now at this crucial hour. And that can only mean that they are more frightened of affairs within Russia than they are of the danger they are inviting for Russia abroad. There's a further observation to make about this trial. It all goes back to the great dogmatic quarrel within the Communist Party in Russia 10 years ago, which ended in the defeat of Trotsky. The bone of contention was whether Russia could establish socialism all by itself, or whether socialism in Russia depended on the whole world being revolutionized. Stalin believed Russia could stand alone. Trotsky was the world revolutionist. Stalin won within the party, and Trotsky was ousted. The men who agreed with Trotsky were utterly sincere. Their belief in world revolution was inscribed in the communist dogma, and believe me, communist dogma is dearer to the communist than the Constitution to any American. Once beaten, these men were supposed to accept the decision of the party, which meant accepting as truth something they just couldn't believe was true. And that is where the trouble began. Now, there are several theories about this trial. One is held by the Trotskyists, and it is that Stalin is an incarnate demon ruthlessly destroying all his enemies. Another theory is that there actually was a conspiracy of the opposition, and that this led to willful sabotage, to contacts with foreign fascist states, to the assassination of Kirov, and finally to a gigantic plot to take the power from Stalin in the event of Russia being attacked in war. Those in opposition believed Stalin was destroying the revolution. They believed a few years ago that Russia would be attacked on two fronts and defeated. And being revolutionists, they wanted to save as much of the revolution as they could after that defeat. So they bargained with the Germans and Japanese as to what should happen in the event of war. They wanted to take over the government of Russia, but they had to make concessions. So they talked of giving Japan the maritime provinces, of opening the Ukraine to Germany, of allowing private interests to enter Russia again, and so on. And then the unexpected happened. Russia became stronger under the Stalin regime. It was not attacked, but the conspiracy was well underway. And in time, it was uncovered bit by bit, hence the trials. Now, this theory is supported by some of the evidence in previous trials, but it can't be trusted too much because the evidence also contains so many inaccuracies. But it is a conjecture that conforms at least with human conduct as outsiders can understand it. Then there was still another theory, and that is the one that is in the indictments as drawn up against the accused. In them, there isn't any shading, no allowance for human nature. The accused become fiends just as fiendish as the Trotskyists think that Stalin is. As to the existence of some conspiracy, I myself think there is real evidence. I call your attention to an article by an American engineer in the Saturday Evening Post last January 1st. His name is John D. Littlepage, and he was for years in charge of inspecting Soviet mines over a vast region. Littlepage tells instances where he saw things happen which could not have been accidental. They were deliberate sabotage. And he tells of being in Berlin with Pyatakov, buying mining machinery. Pyatakov was convicted in the previous trial, and watched him accept graft in a subtle way without being able to understand it until he read Pyatakov's own confession. What you and I can't imagine very well is what an opposition resorts to when it is driven underground. Where men can't resist openly, they resist secretly, until life can become a veritable whirlpool of duplicity, so that one can't know whether to trust his own brother, and one's first desire must be to save one's own life, which means to pick the winning side. My own opinion, and I repeat, it is bound to be superficial, is that there was a conspiracy in Russia, a far-reaching one, one that has produced a gigantic subterranean struggle. One side has won out and is killing off its opponent on the charge of treason. I don't believe much of its evidence. I don't believe the men it is now condemning are fiends, but I do believe this is the kind of a terror that results when men are not free to oppose, when the state sets out to rule their minds, where political conscience, like religious conscience in Germany, is no longer a personal liberty. That is what happens when a state or a party becomes more godlike than the men and women who comprise it. Good evening.
Thank you, Mr. Swing. We have just presented another in the series of broadcasts known as World Events, given by Raymond Graham Swing, international news commentator and foreign correspondent. Raymond Graham Swing's next broadcast over some of these stations will be this coming Monday night at 6:45 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Hereafter, he will be heard regularly at that time. We wish to announce that we will bring to our listeners at 11:15 Eastern Standard Time tonight a special broadcast direct from Los Angeles describing conditions in that area. We will also broadcast at 11:30 Eastern Standard Time from Los Angeles the premiere of the new picture Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm featuring Shirley Temple. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.